August 23rd. They don't need a lecture. They need this.
Which teacher is more worthy? The one who savages his students if their memory fails, or their eye clumsily falters when reading, or the one who prefers to correct and teach with admonitions that bring a blush to the student's cheeks? Show me a brutal tribune or centurion, and I'll show you one who makes soldiers desert, pardonably. Seneca.
As John Steinbeck was writing East of Eden, his son Tom was not taking school seriously. He was acting out. Steinbeck's wife thought Tom needed a lecture about this. Steinbeck then, in the middle of writing about two very different unruly sets of sons, knew that that wasn't quite right. He needs more than that, he wrote in his journal. He needs infinite patience and discipline. Not only is that what your kids need, it's what we all need. Patience and discipline, kindness combined with firmness, in an infinite amount. Nobody wants to be lectured. Nobody wants to be nagged. What we need is to be understood and held accountable. Think of your own troubles as a kid. When you were acting out, when you weren't taking school seriously, when you were getting in trouble, did getting yelled at help? What you really wanted, what you needed, was for someone to see why you were doing these things. You needed someone to guide you back to the right path and help you realize the consequences of being off of it. Patience and discipline, that's what you needed. So give those things to your kids. They deserve them. August 24th. Be something and somebody. E.H. Harriman was a hell of a businessman and a surprisingly good father. He had a reputation as a rapacious industrialist, but at home he was tender and engaged with his kids. He was patient, and he instilled in them good values. Once he wrote to his son's headmaster to ask how the boy was doing in his schooling. Fair in his studies, came the reply, along with news that his young son was gaining steadily. Encouraged, Harriman wrote to his son asking whether he might be able to jack up his efforts in English. I know you can do as well as some other subjects, he wrote. It is encouraging to have you so improved, and I'm sure you will catch on and go on and be something and somebody. That's a perfect phrase. He wasn't telling his son that he needed to get perfect scores. He wasn't telling them that he was worthless for having come up short, or that success was necessarily about being better than anyone else. Like Jim Volvano's father, what the elder Harriman was saying was that he knew what his son was capable of, and more important, what was expected of a person with his potential to be something and somebody. We don't necessarily need our kids to be financially successful or supremely powerful or famous, but we do expect them to make something of themselves, to be somebody, whether that's a respected member of their small church or the head of a legislative body. And we expect them to do something because life is a gift. To waste it? To do the minimum? No, that's a failure for them and us. So let's jack up our effort and our expectations of them. August 25th. Are you telling them this? As a young novelist, Susan Straight was told by her mentor, the great James Baldwin, you must continue to write. It is imperative. Imagine how different that was from the example she got from her own mother, who, as we discussed, believed that her own creative life was over the day she had kids. The question we must ask ourselves is, which path are we choosing? Are we telling them that they must continue to fulfill their potential, that it is imperative? Or through our own actions or inactions, are we telling them the opposite? Have we unknowingly become dream killers? Or are we actively becoming dream builders? That's the question, and it is definitely imperative. There is no benefit to quitting on oneself. Sure, you may have to face facts and choose one career path over another, but that's not the same as stopping. Making money from the thing you love to do is not as important as getting better at it, as maximizing your potential. As parents, it is imperative that we root for them, that we be fans. We have to encourage them. We have to tell them to keep going, that there are more and better things ahead, that the world is going to put up enough stop signs, erect enough obstacles, deliver enough heartbreak. We don't need to add to that. We need to do the opposite. We need to believe in them. August 26th. It's your job to check in. Nobody steals a scene on Seinfeld quite like George's parents, Frank and Estelle Costanza. And naturally, nobody makes George more miserable than they do. They are a crazy, absurd set of parents. In one episode, George has to make his weekly call to them, and it's a task he finds so onerous that he has to prepare things in advance to talk about. The twist, of course, is that George's parents dread the calls themselves, and every Sunday with the calls, they finally complain. In reality, this is precisely backwards. Why is George checking in? That's his parents' job. Your kids didn't choose this life, you did. What does that mean? It means that as your kids get older, there should be none of that "why don't you ever call" nagging. That's your responsibility. That said, if you want the kind of relationship where your kids do call and check in and share what's going on in their lives, it starts when they're much, much younger, when you can't just expect them to open up and share with you, when you have to check in because they don't know that they're struggling or that there's anything worth sharing. Kids simply don't have the experience or the perspective yet to know one way or the other. When it comes to stuff like this, just being there is not enough. You have to seek them out. You have to reach out. You have to gently pry them open. You have to help them realize their own feelings. You have to be more than there. You have to be proactive. August 27th. Other people are trying to do this too. The people you work for, or the people who work for you, they also have a life outside of work. Like you, they are a mother or a father, a son or a daughter. Like you, they have kids and relationships and they struggle to balance it all. Like you, they are trying to put their family first and be a fan. The legendary NBA coach Greg Popovich is a hard-driving boss, but he does his best to help the people who work for and with him. His former assistant coach, Mike Brown, tells the story of when he was going through a separation. His two sons lived with their mom in Colorado, but were visiting him in San Antonio for a week. Brown took them to the airport before he had to catch his own flight for an away game with the Spurs. His boys were crying and begging not to have to get on the plane to be able to stay with their dad. Brown called Coach Pop to tell him he was having some trouble, and he asked him to hold the team plane for a few minutes. Pop told Brown to stay with his kids. No, Brown said. The kids will be fine. If you show up on this plane, Pop told him, you're fired. Come on, man, I'm going to be there, Brown said. Remember, Pop replied, if I see you on this plane, you're fired. Click. Pop hung up on his assistant, and Brown and his boys missed their flight and spent 3 more days together. Can you imagine what it would feel like to have someone do that for you? Maybe not, but maybe you can make it feel a little bit more real by doing it for someone else. August 28th. Don't use your kids. Social media exploits one of the most vulnerable parts in our psyche, our need to be seen and heard and validated. The brilliant programmers of these networks have discovered how to reward this addictive impulse with likes and comments and follower counts. They turned our greatest vulnerabilities into a game. And that's what parents should be worried about. When you're feeling insecure and want to be validated, resist the urge to just post more photos of your kids. Ask yourself, is this really what my kids want? Is this really healthy or appropriate? Or is exploiting their cuteness just a cheap way to get attention and feel better about myself? Being a fan is not about showing off or trying to impress people at dinner conversations or on social media. It's not bragging about where they go to college or how cute they look dressed up for their birthday. Our job is to take care of them, not exploit them. Don't turn your kids or the precious experiences you have with them into fodder for this insatiable maw. August 29th. Teach them to be a good sport. How someone handles winning and losing reveals so much about their character. The earlier kids are taught this, the more prepared they'll be for the real world, which includes plenty of both. In his essay on anger, Seneca lays out some specific advice for fathers when it comes to teaching their kids how to be good sports. He writes, "In contests with his comrades, we ought not allow him to become sulky or fly into a passion. Let us see him be on friendly terms with those he contends with, so that in the struggle itself he may learn not to wish to hurt his antagonist, but to conquer him. Whenever he has gained the day or done something praiseworthy, we should allow him to enjoy his victory, but not rush into the transports of delight, for joy leads to exultation, and exultation leads to swaggering and excessive self-esteem." This is important. We want our kids to possess the will to win, but not so much that it possesses them. We want them to feel good when they win without being so dependent or addicted to that feeling that they are crushed when inevitably they lose. We don't want their successes to fuel their ego or their shortcomings on the field to lead to insecurity or self-loathing. It is, like all things, about balance, and most of all, about being respectful, being responsible, and enjoying the process more than the results. August 30th. This is what it takes to thrive. Several years ago, the writer Malcolm Gladwell pointed out how surprising it is that even in the NBA, which is filled with objectively talented and elite athletes, it sometimes requires a team change or a head coaching change or a mental skills professional for a player to thrive. They might have bounced around two or three different places, had multiple disappointing seasons, and then suddenly, when the environment around them is right, when they have the support they need, bam, they're great. His point was this, that if even athletes being paid millions of dollars to perform need this, how can we possibly just expect kids to succeed in any old classroom we drop them into? We are so quick to write kids off, even our own kids, as not good at math, as being a so-and-so student, or having trouble focusing, or whatever. So quick. But of course, environment is everything. The right supporting cast is everything. Timing is everything. We have to be patient. We have to be flexible. We can't stop rooting for them, believing in them. We have to take a page from these sports teams who, understanding that they have a very valuable asset on their hands, do not despair when things don't immediately click. No, when things aren't working, they invest more. They don't blame the star, they blame the system, and they try to fix it. And the fans cheer like crazy the whole time. Well, our kids are even more priceless than any basketball player, and their education is more important than playing a game well. August 31st, being a fan isn't easy. It was a time when women didn't have jobs, let alone become published authors, not respectable women anyway. And yet there, Jane Austen's father was submitting Jane's writings to a publisher. As I am well aware of what consequence it is that a work of this sort should make its first appearance under a respectable name, I apply to you, he wrote to a well-known publisher, according to Claire Tomalin's Jane Austen, A Life. Being a fan of your kids is not just rooting for them at the occasional soccer game. It's not just telling them that they're special. It's also about putting yourself out there, taking risks for them. It's being willing to defy conventions, to encourage them to defy conventions. They feel that their calling demands it. You tried your whole life to raise a kid who was comfortable with themselves, who was confident, who was competent, who could be successful. When your efforts begin to bear fruit, real challenges will sprout up alongside. As they push the boundaries of their comfort zone, they may well push up against yours. But that's good. That's what we want. We have to believe in our kids, to be their fans, to be willing to risk with and for them. If we don't believe in our kids, who will? Be a real fan. It's not easy. But where would the world be if great parents had taken the easy route? September. Raise a reader. Lessons in learning and curiosity. September 1st. This is the great leveler. Not all of us are able to give our children riches or powerful connections or even superior genetics. Does this mean that our kids are at a disadvantage, that they're screwed? Nope, because there is a great leveler out there, one that we can show them and they can use at any time. The famous Princeton basketball coach Pete Carroll would tell his young athletes, "My father came from the province of Leon in Castile, Spain, and worked for 39 years in the open hearth for the Bethlehem Steel Company. Every day before he left for work, he would remind my sister and me how important it was to be smart. In this life," he would say, "the big, strong guys are always taking from the smaller, weaker guys. But the smart take from the strong." It's simple fatherly wisdom. Use your brain. It's the secret weapon of underdogs everywhere, available to all and always free. September 2nd. This is how you teach them.
They say I tell a great many stories. I reckon I do. But I have learned from long experience that plain people, take them as they run, are more easily influenced through the medium of a proud and humorous illustration than any other way. Abraham Lincoln.
If the Bible is any indication, Jesus seemed to rarely come out and say what he meant. He preferred instead to employ parables and stories and little anecdotes that made you think. He tells the story of the servants and the talents. He tells the story of the prodigal son, the good Samaritan, the mustard seed, and the lost sheep. And it turns out that's a pretty effective way to get a point across and make it stick. And so it will be with your kids. We learn through stories, whether it's the story of Cincinnatus or the story about the time when you were their age. We learn when people share moments of vulnerability, of their hard-won experience. We don't like it when people tell us the point. We like it when they show us. So stop thinking about giving them all the answers and start thinking about stories that make the answers self-evident. It's the best way to teach. September 3rd, introduce them to the friendly world of ideas.
Our first job, our first responsibility, is instilling a sense of learning, a sense of a love of learning, in our kids. Barack Obama.
The Marine General and former U.S. Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, has talked about his idyllic childhood in Pullman, Washington. There, he spent time outdoors, explored, got in trouble, and had an all-American childhood. He talks lovingly of a house filled with books, run by parents who encouraged their children not only to read, but to question and interact with them as well. He recalls that they introduced us to the world of great ideas, not a fearful place, but a place to enjoy. What a thing to say and a target for each of us to aim for with our own children. You must teach your kids to be curious, to be open, to be willing to explore. Your job is to teach them how to make their own informed opinions, how to decide for themselves, how to be comfortable with uncomfortable topics. Ideas are our friends. They will serve your children well, and your children will serve them well if you teach them early and often. The world is a place of great ideas, and there's nothing to be afraid of except fear and ignorance. September 4th. Teach them early when you still can.
To learn is simply to allow something to be done to you, and to be quickly persuaded is natural for those who are less able to offer resistance. Plutarch.
We have to start teaching our kids the important things early, even when it seems like they are too young, because if we wait, they'll be able to fight us off. They'll have words and the resolve to resist the lessons we know they will need in life for the struggles they can't yet see coming. We have to get them while they're still young and impressionable. We have to push past their reservations. Of course they would rather play video games. Of course it's more fun to goof off. But now is the time, before they can fight us off with full determination, before the cement is completely dry. September 5th. Do you do this over dinner?
He who cannot put his thoughts on ice should not enter into the heat of dispute. Friedrich Nietzsche.
Some families watch TV at dinner. Some families eat separately. Some families talk idly about their day. Dinner at Agnes Callard's house is different. She and her children debate. Because Callard is a philosopher, many of their debates are philosophical. If a conjoined twin committed a crime, should both twins be punished? Is it possible for the other twin to be completely innocent? But some topics are silly, such as the debate led by her 7-year-old on what would be the ideal type of glove. It wasn't the content of the debate that mattered. Of course, it was the activity. It was that they did it as a family. And like most great parenting strategies, it wasn't some forced or formal activity. It wasn't an obligation or a chore. These debates began as discussions between her and her husband that her kids wanted to join. They evolved over time. The rules are ad hoc. The tradition is organic. But in the end, it shaped the course of her family and their intellectual lives. Can you say the same about your dinners? Maybe you should talk about it then. Maybe even debate it. September 6th, how to get them to read or do anything.
A reader lives 1,000 lives before he dies. The man who never reads lives only one. George R.R. Martin.
In her classic poem, Tula, books are door-shaped, Margarita Engel describes books as door-shaped portals, which is as apt as it is beautiful. Books carry us across oceans and centuries, she writes, with an extra benefit of making us feel less alone. Stephen King's line was that books are uniquely portable magic. We want to give our kids access to this magic. We want them to walk through these portals. We want them to read. Reading anything is better than watching so much TV or playing the iPad or texting endlessly on their phone, after all. But are we doing enough to motivate them to pick up a book? Are we providing a good example? How often do your kids catch you reading? How often do they see you with a book in your hands? You want them to read, but do you read regularly to them? You tell them that books are important, books are fun, but where is the evidence? If you want your kids to read more, if you want them to walk through those magical door-shaped portals, show them what a reader looks like. Talk to them about books. Make books a central part of your house and your lives. September 7th. The lives of the greats remind us. Why do we tell stories to our kids? Why do we tell them about history? Teach them about Martin Luther King Jr., George Washington, Portia Cato, Cincinnatus, Florence Nightingale, Jesus, Marcus Aurelius? Because it matters. As Longfellow wrote, lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time. We are trying to teach our kids the most important and pressing lesson of all, that they can make a difference, that they can change the world. We tell our kids stories to inspire them. That's what bedtime reading is about, not tiring them out so they'll go to sleep. The point of history isn't to berate them with the evil deeds of old dead white guys. We want them to know people can have an impact. People can lead wonderful lives. People can leave their footprints on the sands of time. Not just people, not just heroes or the dynastically wealthy, but your kids too. They can do this. And in helping them realize that, you are making your own impact. September 8th. Are you bringing this home?
A child learns more in one split second carving a little stick than in whole days listening to a teacher. Simone Rodriguez.
Orville and Wilbur Wright were bicycle salesmen from Ohio. They weren't engineers, they didn't go to college, they didn't have any technical training. Meanwhile, there were teams of engineers from the top universities working on the same problem. One was funded by a grant from the U.S. War Department. How could the Wrights have possibly bested those deep pockets to become the inventors and the pioneers we know them as today? It began for them with a toy, David McCullough writes in The Wright Brothers, a a small helicopter brought home by their father, Bishop Milton Wright, a great believer in the educational value of toys. It was a little more than a stick with twin propellers and twisted rubber bands, and probably cost 50 cents. It might not seem like a toy could change a child's life, but of course it can. Toys are more than just things to play with. They are worlds to discover. They are things to be responsible for. They are things to take apart and put back together. They are laboratories for life. We spend a lot of time introducing our kids to the world of ideas. Let's also carve out some time to bring home cool toys. Toys with educational value. Toys that teach them about other cultures. Toys that get them interested in flight or science or math or history or technology. Toys that are in and of themselves vessels for ideas. Who knows what might come from their exploration of fun. September 9th. Teach them to notice.
Pay attention. It's all about paying attention. It's all about taking in as much of what's out there as you can. Susan Sontag.
When the former diplomat and Secretary of Defense Robert Lovett was a kid, he and his dad took similar routes in the morning and evening to work and to school. The fact that they left the places at slightly different times allowed Lovett and his dad to play an interesting game. At night, after dinner, according to biographers Walter Isaacson and Evan Thompson, Lovett's dad would ask questions about what he had seen. How many horses were pulling the cart, he would ask about a Midtown construction project. How many girders were in the cart? How many horses were hitched to the cart? There would be a few quarters as a reward if young Robert was right, but he would be docked a quarter from his winnings if he got anything wrong. This was more than just a silly activity they did together, although such things are wonderful. What his father was teaching him was the art of paying attention. Robert was learning to notice, to focus on the details, to not take his surroundings for granted, to be present. It was a skill he used to great advantage as he rose through the diplomatic ranks of the State Department. Of course, you don't have to play the same game, but you can find your own way to inspire your kids to pay attention. The quarters and the pats on the back they will win will be nice in the moment, but they will pale in comparison to the real gift you have given them, which will last a lifetime. September 10th. Beautiful is what they say it is. There is an old Lego ad from the early 1980s. It has a little pigtailed redhead holding her Lego creation. What is it? Honestly, it's hard to tell. It's basically random blocks snapped together. One of the Lego men has a tree on his head. Needless to say, no architect would sign off on this project. But the smile on the cute little kid's face says it all. Have you ever seen anything like it? The copy on the ad reads, "Not just what she's made, but how proud it's made her." It's a look you'll see whenever children build something all by themselves. No matter what they've created, Lego Universal building sets will help your children discover something very, very special, themselves. As parents and adults, it can be so easy to step in and tell your kids how it's supposed to go. Trees don't go on people's heads. A window doesn't make sense there, but where will they sleep? Dogs and cats aren't friends. There's no air and space. And we think we are helping or that we are teaching. But really, we are stepping on their ability to create and imagine. We may well be depriving them of that beautiful look of pride that the little girl in the ad has, the one that comes from doing something all by yourself and discovering yourself in the process. Playtime is for play. It's supposed to be silly. It's supposed to be fun. There are no rules. None of it matters, unless they want it to matter. So give them some space. Encourage them. Just watch. Let them be beautiful. September 11th. This is how you make them smart.
I have no special talents. I am only passionately curious. Albert Einstein.
There is a story about Sandra Day O'Connor in Evan Thomas's great book, First. During one of Washington's every 17-year eruption of dormant cicadas, he writes, O'Connor collected a batch of the large dead insects and sent them in a shoebox to her grandchildren in Arizona. Her clerk was baffled. O'Connor explained, one of the most important things to me is that my children and grandchildren are curious. Because if you're not curious, you're not smart. We don't have control over what kind of brain our kids are born with. We don't really even control what kind of college they'll get into. Are they a math kid or an artist, right-brained or left-brained? That's not up to us. But what we can influence is whether they're curious. We can encourage this instinct, asking them questions and rewarding them for asking their own. We can cultivate this instinct until it becomes a personality trait, finding all sorts of interesting things and showing them to our kids. And we can demonstrate it, pouring fuel on the sparks of curiosity they exhibit by engaging with the things we're curious about too. We can't make them a specific kind of genius, but we can make them smart by showing them how to be curious. September 12th. This is something to invest in.
When I have a little money, I buy books. And if I have any left, I buy food and clothes. Erasmus.
You work hard for your family. You know how you sweated for each dollar, which can make those dollars hard to spend. Especially if you have an eye towards investing, every dollar expended now comes at the cost of returns in the future. That's one way to think about it, but it's not the only way. Marcus Aurelius writes that what he learned from his great-grandfather was to avoid public schools, to hire good private teachers, and to accept the resulting costs as money well spent. What Marcus was talking about was investing in your children's education, whatever form you decide it will take. A tutor to teach them Spanish a couple times a month, a piano instructor, a yearly pass to the museum downtown, the gas and the commute to the magnet school on the other side of town instead of the closer, less rigorous one, private tuition, one parent working less so you can homeschool. None of this is cheap, but don't think of it as an expense. Think of it as an investment. It's the most important investment you can make. It's an investment in their knowledge, in their education, in the future. It's making them better, and it's worth what it costs. September 13th, you have to unlock this. It wasn't until law school that future Secretary of State Dean Acheson was fully unlocked as a human being. There, he said, with the help of his professors, he was introduced to a tremendous discovery, as he called it. It was the discovery of the power of thought, he said. Not only did I become aware of this powerful mechanism, the brain, but I became aware of an unlimited mass of material that was lying about the world waiting to be stuffed into the brain. It was this discovery that propelled him to become not just one of the top legal minds of his time, but eventually the country's principal diplomat. Yet it's also a little sad. He went to Groton School, to Yale College, and to Harvard Law School. His parents were smart too, but somehow nobody had been able or interested enough to get him to realize the power of thought till he was in his mid-20s. It's unreal. Just as we have to help introduce our kids to the world of ideas, we also have to help them discover the incredible power of thought. We have to give them a sense of the limitlessness of human potential trapped in these 3 pounds of soft tissue between our ears. We have to show them what a powerful mechanism they have been given. We have to show them how to use it. We need to unlock their brains as early as possible. September 14th. Not just to read, but to read critically.
To read attentively, not to be satisfied with just getting the gist of it. Marcus Aurelius.
An illiterate world is not a good one, but a world where people unthinkingly believe and accept everything they read is not much better. So it's great that you're teaching your kids to read, but are you teaching them to read critically? They need to know authors can be wrong, authors can be questioned. A book is not a one-way conversation, it's a dialogue between the reader and the writer, between the past and the present. Show them how to take notes, how to disagree, how to question what they see on the page, and how to participate in the dialogue that has begun in the pages they are holding. They need to know no one book is definitive, no school or system has all the answers. Show them how to read books from opposing thinkers. Read one book together, then read something that presents a different point of view. Talk about the importance of debate, how to compare and contrast. Teach them to be more than a reader. Teach them to be a wide-ranging critical reader, a questioner, a reviewer, a thinker. September 15th, protect this impulse. The famed French photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson was a pain in the ass to his teachers. He was bored by what they were teaching in school. He didn't pay attention. He was constantly getting caught reading something that had nothing to do with his schoolwork, books that were often inappropriate for his age. One day, about to start sixth grade, he was caught by a principal reading two beautiful French poets. At first, the principal seemed like he'd finally had enough. "Let's have no more disorder in your studies," he barked. Every other time Henry had been addressed this way, it had been followed with punishment. But then the principal's voice turned to kindness. "You are going to read in my office," he said, and led the boy there, where Henry returned over and over again as a precocious, curious reader for the rest of his school days. It was this conversation, this little bit of intellectual guardianship and protection of his curiosity, that helped him carve out the foundations and freedom that would lead him to become one of the greatest photographers in history. We have to remember that our job as parents, as educators, is not to keep our kids in line for its own sake. It's not to crush their initiative because it's disruptive or uncomfortable or difficult for us. We have to encourage them. We have to make space for our kids. If they want to read, by God, let them. If they want to skip ahead or deviate from the conventional path, cheer them on. Who knows? They may well have just found their way. September 16th. It's about the right moment.
There is a select group of writers who are accessible to anyone at whatever age or stage of life. Homer, Shakespeare, Goethe, Balzac, Tolstoy. And then there are those whose significance is not properly revealed until a particular moment. Stefan Zweig.
Maybe they can understand Ender's Game at 11, or maybe it won't be until they're 17. Maybe they can get the message of The Great Gatsby in high school, or maybe it's something you'll have to read as a kind of family book club later on. Maybe they'll take to poetry early, or maybe they won't. Maybe they'll love The Little Prince or Charlotte's Web as much as you did. Or maybe tonight is just not the night. Stefan Zweig was 20 years old when he first picked up Montaigne's Essays, an incomparable book, but he had little idea what to do with it. It wasn't until the last year of his life, after two world wars and a forced exile, that Zweig picked up Montaigne again. This time, the connection was instant. Impact was enormous because the moment was right. Remember, our goal here is to raise readers. But as with gardening, there is a time and a season for certain things to take root. And until you get there, the thing you'll need most is patience. September 17th, you gotta give them access.
The story of Theodore Roosevelt is the story of a small boy who read about great men and decided he wanted to be like them. Herman Hagedorn.
Theodore Roosevelt certainly came from a privileged family. They were rich. They were social elites. They had a mansion in Manhattan. And yet, as Doris Kearns Goodwin wrote, his main advantage was actually pretty simple. Few children read as broadly or had such access to books as young Roosevelt, she writes. He had only to pick up a volume on the shelves of the vast library in his family's home or express interest in a particular book, and it would magically materialize. During one family vacation, Theodore proudly reported that he and his younger brother and sister, Elliot and Corrine, had devoured 50 novels. His father read aloud to his children in the evenings after dinner, she said. Above all, he sought to impart didactic principles of duty, ethics, and morality through stories and fables and maxims. It would be wonderful if we could hand our kids a famous last name, a legacy admission to Harvard, or a trust fund, but that is difficult to do. What you can do, what you must do, is give them access to a library, to an unlimited number of books. Bring them up in a house that, even if it lacks rich heritage or fame or noble lineage like the Roosevelts, it is at least rich in a love of reading. September 18th, the two most important skills to teach your kids. Looking back on his surprise path to the presidency, one of Gerald Ford's main regrets came from the course of study he took in college. He would write in his memoirs that if he could go back, the two main things he would have studied were writing and public speaking. Writing well and speaking confidently and articulately before an audience were the two main skills he used in every facet of his life as a leader, and they were the two things that, like most students, he got the least instruction in. With all that's changed since Ford went to college, class of 35, how little has actually happened to disrupt that? Nothing remains more important than effective communication. Kids learn dance in PE, but public speaking and debate are optional extracurricular activities. How nuts is that? Kids are evaluated on standardized tests as if effective communication could possibly be captured via multiple choice. In fact, the questions and passages on standardized tests are often the epitome of poor writing and ineffective communication. If schools aren't going to do it, we parents have to. It's on us to teach our kids these important skills to make sure they are able to express themselves on the page and in person. We've got to give them the opportunities to get up and address an audience and encourage the confidence required to be able to do so. Whatever happens in the future, communication will be key and king. It's your job to make sure they are ready. September 19th. Let's get to the bottom of it.
How could youths better learn to live than by at once trying the experiment of living? Methinks this would exercise their minds as much as mathematics. Henry David Thoreau.
The author Susan Cheever tells the story of Henry David Thoreau, who before he became a great writer was a teacher. The school he taught at was close to a river, and it was the source of endless fascination to the kids, and mainly they were curious about what made so many of the interesting sounds that came from the water. It has been disputed whether the noise has come from frogs, one student later reflected. Mr. Thoreau, however, caught three very small frogs, two of them in the act of chirping. While bringing them home, one of them chirped in his hat. Isn't that lovely? He didn't just dismiss their questions with an obvious answer. He showed them how you go to the source of things. He showed them the importance of following your curiosity. Thoreau was full of demonstrations like that. For instance, he gave each student a small plot of land and taught them how to survey together, how to grow plants, and how to observe what was happening on their plots. Yeah, we're busy. Yeah, we know stuff, but we can't just tell them what we know. We have to show them. We have to roll up our sleeves, take off our hats, get to the bottom of stuff together. September 20th. Provide them with this unusual advantage. More than three decades after their first famous flight, a journalist asked Orville and Wilbur Wright how they did it. How did two brothers with no money, no influence, and no other special advantages do what specialists with all those advantages couldn't do? It isn't true, Orville corrected, to say that we had no special advantages. We did have unusual advantages in childhood, without which I doubt we could have accomplished much. And what was that unusual advantage? The greatest thing in our favor, Orville explained, was growing up in a family where there was always much encouragement to intellectual curiosity. If my father had not been the kind who encouraged his children to pursue intellectual interests without any thought of profit, our early curiosity about flying would have been nipped too early to bear fruit. We have to do this. We have to cultivate their curiosities, whatever they may be. We have to encourage their interests without any thought of whether they'll be able to profit from them. We don't have to be special or specialists to give our kids this unusual advantage. September 21st. Raise them to be a why child. In F. Scott Fitzgerald's short story, Head and Shoulders, the young prodigy Horace explains, I was a why child. I wanted to see the wheels go round. My father was a young economics professor at Princeton. He brought me up on the system of answering every question I asked to the best of his ability. A why child. What a delightful phrase. Isn't that what we're trying to raise? A child who knows how to figure things out? A child who isn't content to simply take things at face value? Who isn't satisfied with simple explanations? Can this be annoying? Sure. Can even get them into trouble. But curious is better than complacent, and annoying is better than ignorant. To be sure, there will be times when you're too tired to answer their questions. There will be moments when you feel like their questions are inappropriate. But in those moments, you must pause and breathe and remember that you have to seed this habit. You have to make sure that you water it too, and that you do your best never to stamp it out. The more questions they ask, the better. Not just for you or for them, but for the world that they live in. September 22nd. Show them what they'll get out of this. The way to teach a kid to love books, as the great lover of books Robert Greene has said, is by appealing to self-interest. Show them what they will get out of books, tangibly, immediately. Better yet, find them a book that will have a big payoff for them. President Joe Biden has talked about how reading earlier in his life about the orator Demosthenes and his speech impediment helped him overcome his own stutter. You think an experience like that early on doesn't turn a person into a reader for life? Find them books that will entertain them. Find them books that will help them get their crush to like them, that will make them laugh, that will piss their teachers off, that will help them learn a new skill or solve a problem or feel less alone. Focus on the ROI, because that's what books are, investments. You put down a few dollars, you commit several hours, and you get something back. To get your kids to read, you will have to be a reader, of course, but you will also have to show them what they will get out of books. Or why else would they bother? September 23rd. Never make fun of them for this. Your kids will do all sorts of ridiculous things. They will trip and fall, and yes, you will sometimes laugh. You will tease them about this and that. They will make hilarious mistakes. They will look back on their own childish ridiculousness with amusement. Your family will have all sorts of inside jokes. And this is fine. This is wonderful. It's what binds people together, the ability to bust each other's balls, to share memories and experiences. One biographer of Harry Truman noted that the former president mispronounced a reasonable number of words, which in the beginning he said puzzled me. And then I realized that while he had often read them, he had seldom, if ever, spoken the words aloud, not even in many cases heard them spoken aloud. It's essential that your house and your relationship be a safe place for the mispronunciation of words. Do not make them feel self-conscious about reading, about tackling topics outside their comfort zone. This is how they grow. Tease them and have fun about many things, but mispronouncing a word, respect it. Encourage it. And if you want to fix this problem, start by expanding your own vocabulary. September 24th. Are you showing them how to be a student?
Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Learn as if you were to live forever. Gandhi.
If you think back to when you were a kid, what appeared to you to be the best part about being an adult? No more school. Our parents didn't have to carry around heavy books or do homework. We never saw them applying to get into this school or that one. It's sort of sad that, by and large, we show our kids that education stops. That while adulthood isn't always fun, one perk is that you no longer have to go to class, that graduation is a final destination. It doesn't have to be this way. There's the story of Epictetus teaching one day when a student's arrival caused a commotion in the back of class. Who was it? It was Hadrian, the emperor. Hadrian's example clearly had an impact on his successor and adopted grandson, Marcus Aurelius. Late in his reign, a friend spotted Marcus heading out, carrying a stack of books. "Where are you going?" he asked. Marcus was on his way to a lecture on Stoicism, he said, "for learning is a good thing even for one who is growing old. I am now on my way to Sextus the philosopher to learn that which I do not yet know." If you want your kids to value learning, if you want them to never stop furthering the education you've been investing so much time and money and worry into, then we have to show them what an adult committed to lifelong learning actually looks like. We have to show them that we have not graduated, that we are not on summer break, and we have not arrived at the final destination of education. Wisdom, they must learn, is an endless pursuit. September 25th. Make sure they spend time around old people. In his book, The Vanishing American Adult, former Senator Ben Sasse pondered what might strike a person from the distant past as odd about our modern society. Aside from the technology, he said they notice the extreme age segregation. Invariably, today we spend time almost exclusively with people our own age. Our kids go to school with other kids. We work with other adults. Our own parents and grandparents are shunted off to retirement communities and old folks' homes and cruise ships. The average age in the U.S. Senate, where Sasse worked, is around 61. There are only 10 senators as of this writing who were younger than him. The closest they get to young people are summer interns, pages, and junior legislative aides. When was the last time you stayed under the roof as someone twice your age? How many conversations do you have with people who grew up without the things you take completely for granted? In Laurie McKenna's song, Humble and Kind, she talks about visiting grandpa every chance that you can. But it actually requires more than that, more than just seeing your own family. You have to make sure your kids aren't stuck in a bubble, living their lives away from anyone but other children. Instead, you have to expose them to wisdom, expose them to people who remember the good and bad things that humans did in very recent and not so recent times. Expose them to people who have learned painful lessons. Expose them to people who have accomplished incredible things. Otherwise, all that wisdom might be lost, and so might your children. September 26. It's about learning, not memorization.
To know by heart is not to know. Michel de Montaigne.
It's time for us to review your multiplication tables, you tell them. Let's look over your vocab flashcards. Maybe you're one of those parents who makes their kids recite poems or plays, who sign them up for speech competitions. Maybe you're drilling them for a spelling bee right now. It's all making them smarter, you tell yourself. But is it, or is it just teaching them how to act smart? We're not trying to raise robots. We want kids who can think, can figure stuff out. Who cares what they can recite? We want them to know what something means as much as we want them to know what it is. We want them to love learning, not trivia. So make sure your priorities are aligned. Make sure the activities you design actually get you closer to that goal. Make sure you're focused on the right stuff. Teach them to know. That's what counts. September 27th. What game are you teaching them? There are two types of games in this life, finite and infinite. Finite games are things you do once and then they're over. An infinite game is more like life itself. It goes on and everything is interrelated and independent. The former is zero sum, the latter is non-zero sum. Tobias Lütke, the founder of Shopify, tries to live life as an infinite game. He also tries to make sure he's not sending mixed messages to his kids. We talk to our children about education as an infinite game, he has said. We tell them that it's about the love of learning, that it's a lifelong pursuit, that it's about developing into the best person you can be. But then we send them off with strong expectations of winning the game first grade. This sounds familiar, right? We've all caught ourselves comparing our kids' grades with other kids. We've talked to other parents about what grade level they're reading at or doing math at or what percentile they're in statewide. We've obsessed over GPA and standardized test scores as if this were the keys to the kingdom. Of what exactly? Then we grill our college kids about whether they found their major yet, about whether the major they picked is going to snag them a high-paying job or not. You want kids who are in this for life. You want kids who don't think in zero-sum terms. Teach them to play the infinite game. Teach them by playing it yourself. September 28th. They must be surrounded by this.
No man has a right to bring up his children without surrounding them with books. Horace Mann.
Do you know Lewin's equation? You're actually experiencing the implications of it as you read it. Behavior is a function of a person and their environment. Our habits, our actions, our lives, they're determined by our surroundings. So what does this mean for us as parents? Well, we are largely the architects of our kids' environment. We all have different means and ends, but within those means, we control what we surround our children with. The influences, the colors, the moods, the people, the interactions. And of course, the most important thing there is to a child's intellectual development, the books. If you want them to be readers, you have to design the environment of a reader, as an architect does. You have to surround them with books, good ones, silly ones, short ones, long ones, used ones, new ones. You have to display them prominently in your house. You have to take your kids to libraries and independent bookstores. Otherwise, how else could they possibly become a reader? September 29th. Don't baby them when it comes to books.
Modern books for children are rather horrible things, especially when you see them in the mass. George Orwell.
Not long ago, kids were taught Latin and Greek so they could read the classics in their original languages. Think of Aesop's Fables. Think of children being read Plutarch's Lives by their parents. This is heavy stuff, and purposefully so. When you read old school books, you find that what you're really doing is acquainting yourself with obscure yet illustrative figures from the ancient world, while also displaying a willingness to wrestle with timeless and morally complex topics. These days, though, the children and young adult sections of bookstores overflow with infantilizing escapism, fantastical melodrama, just plain old absurd nonsense. The curmudgeons among us want to blame the millennials and Gen Z for this. Their laziness and faltering tastes are why we're so awash in this stuff. But do you really believe that our kids are dumber than the kids of Orwell's time or back before that? Of course not. They're kids. We're the problem. Parents, adults, educators, publishers, as a collective, we've stopped believing that our kids are capable of reading challenging books. So we provide them with kids' editions and silly picture books instead of helping them build their reading muscles. And then we wonder why they can't handle heavy stuff. Well, stop it. Push them. Push yourself. They aren't babies, or at least they shouldn't be, after they've learned to read and think for themselves. September 30th. Do they have a project? Mastery doesn't come from rote recitation. It comes from falling in love with something. It comes from hard work, sure, but only when that hard work is aligned with a passionate love of a subject or a craft or a field. Forget credentialing. Give them something to sink their teeth into. As Paul Graham wrote, if I had to choose between my kids getting good grades and working on ambitious projects of their own, I'd pick the projects. And not because I'm an indulgent parent, but because I've been on the other end and I know which has more predictive value. When I was picking startups for Y Combinator, I didn't care about applicants' grades, but if they'd worked on projects of their own, I wanted to hear all about those. If you want a kid who has real skill and real passion in this world, you would be well served to do the same. October. Struggle and emerge. How to raise their resilience. October 1st. A child's life should be good, not easy. The Stoic philosopher Seneca got front row seats to one of the worst parenting jobs in history. In 49 AD, he was recalled from exile to tutor a 12-year-old named Nero. The ancient historian Cassius Dio tells us that the boy's mother, the Empress Agrippina, had the entire empire under her thumb and used her power to make sure that her boy never had to struggle for anything. She was what we might call today a snowplow parent, and in clearing the path of every conceivable impediment and obstacle, Agrippina created a monster, one of the worst human beings in history. It's little mystery why we see Seneca write over and over again about the importance of struggling with and overcoming adversity. The job of a good parent, he says, is to, out of love for the child, act as a trainer and endlessly manufacture trials for the child. The job of a good parent is to make their child's life good, but not easy. There is a great Latin expression, lucter et emergo. It means I struggle and emerge. I wrestle with and overcome. The gods, Seneca writes, want us to be as good and as virtuous as possible, and so they assign to us a fortune that will make us struggle. Without struggle, he says, no one will know what you are capable of, not even yourself. It's hard not to be a snowplow or a helicopter parent. We love our kids so much, we want nothing but the best for them. We can't bear the thought, let alone the sight of their struggling. But we have to let them scramble through the brambles and the pitfalls of growing up. We have to remind ourselves day after day, a child's life should be good, not easy. October 2nd. You can't prevent them from making mistakes. In the novel Siddhartha, the title character tries desperately to convince his son of the importance of the simple way of life, having learned the wisdom of it through painful experience. Like you, like all parents, he watches as his son ignores his warnings, despairing as he goes the wrong direction. Confiding in frustration to his friend, Siddhartha is hit with this question. Do you really believe that you have committed your follies so that your son may be spared them? It would be wonderful if our children didn't have to learn through trial and error, if they could simply accept our advice and start where we left off, rather than touch the proverbial hot stove for themselves. But we should be wise enough as human beings by now to know that it is simply not how life works. Much of what we learn has to be learned on our own. Some mistakes have to be made to be fully understood. Don't your own experiences teach you that anyway? How many of your parents' warnings did you really heed? You can't prevent your kids from making mistakes. You have to give them the space to learn on their own. But you can take solace in the knowledge that you've instilled the character, the awareness, the willingness to ask for help they will need in order to bounce back from the mistakes they will inevitably make. October 3rd. This is the main lesson.
The chief task in life is simply this: to identify and separate matters so that I can say clearly to myself which are externals not under my control and which have to do with the choices I actually control. Where then do I look for good and evil? Not to uncontrollable externals, but within myself to the choices that are my own. Epictetus.
There is a lesson underneath nearly everything we want to teach our kids. It's a heady one, but it's also a very simple one. The lesson you have to teach them happens to be the core of Stoic philosophy and also the key to success in life. And it's this: we don't control what happens, we control how we respond to what happens. Your daughter thinks that a teacher is unfair and doesn't like them. Okay, that very well may be true. So what is she going to do about it? The coach says that your son is too short to play basketball. Same thing. Screwed up and failed their math test. The bully on the playground only got into their safety school. Same, same, same. Teach your kids not to wallow in these misfortunes, but to focus on what is next. Guide them towards putting their energy toward their response, because that's what's up to them. That is the superpower they have. And if you teach them that, then they have it. October 4th, make them do their own stuff.
Sit and pray your nose doesn't run. Or, rather, just wipe your nose and stop seeking a scapegoat. Epictetus.
There is a great story about a young Spartan woman, Gorgo, who would one day become queen. Despite her royal status, like all Spartans, she was raised to be self-sufficient, with no frills or needless luxury. So imagine Gorgo's surprise when she witnessed a distinguished visitor to Sparta have his shoes put on by a servant. "Look, father," she said innocently to her father, the King Leonidas, "that stranger has no hands." Sadly, for some of us, it could just as easily be deduced that our kids have no hands and no brains. We put their clothes on for them. We make their decisions. We clear the road in front like a snowplow. We hover like a helicopter just in case something goes wrong. We do everything for them. And then we wonder why they are helpless. We wonder why they have trouble with anxiety or low self-esteem. Confidence is something you earn. It comes from self-sufficiency. It comes from experience. And when we coddle and baby them, when we take away their hands, we deprive them of these critical assets. And it's not right. And it's not fair. October 5th. Don't be like this. In early 2021, the musician John Roderick was rightfully criticized by parents all over the world for missing the point on how to teach kids. His daughter was hungry. He was busy. She wanted to cook some beans. He wanted her to figure out how to do it on her own. As he worked on a jigsaw puzzle, she struggled to open the can of baked beans with a can opener. She struggled and struggled and struggled. "Will you please just open the can?" she said. He wouldn't, wanting this to be a lesson. She kept trying. He kept making suggestions and tweeting about it. And this went on and on for 6 hours until she finally opened the can. Roderick was deemed bean dad for his efforts. There's a difference between being a supportive parent and being a bean dad. There's a difference between letting your kid wrestle with difficulty so they can be better for it and letting them fumble with a can so you can tweet a story. No, our job isn't to open every can for them, nor is it to let them struggle in the dark for 6 hours. Step in and show them how to be self-sufficient. Show them how the damn can opener works. Start the can for them for the first time and let them take it from there. Be a guide. Don't be a bean dad. October 6th. Help them forge this.
Just as in fair weather, then, one ought to prepare for the storm, so also in youth, one should store up discipline and self-restraint as a provision for old age. Plutarch.
Theodore Roosevelt spent almost every day during the first 12 years of his life struggling with horrible asthma. The attacks were an almost nightly near-death experience. He was bedridden for weeks at a time. Born into great wealth and status, he could have remained weak, and he could have been taken care of throughout his life. Then one day, his father came to his room and delivered a message that would change the young boy's life. "Theodore, you have got the mind, but you have not got the body," he said, "and without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should." Roosevelt's younger sister, who witnessed this conversation, recalled how the young, fragile boy looked at his father and said with determination, "I'll make my body." It was the beginning of his preparation for and the fulfillment of what he would call the strenuous life. He worked out every day thereafter. By his early 20s, his battle with asthma was over. Roosevelt had worked the weakness out of his body. Not everyone simply accepts the cards they are dealt. They remake their bodies and their lives with activities and exercise. They prepare themselves for the hard road. Do they hope they never have to walk it? Sure, but they are prepared for it in any case. And your kids? Nobody is born with a steel backbone. It has to be forged. And your job is to help your kids forge theirs. October 7th. Teach them to handle things. Robert Lovett, the U.S. Secretary of Defense under President Truman, once said, "You may think this is a small thing, but you'd be amazed at the number of people I met in Washington during the war who had never learned how to handle anything by themselves." If you want your kids to stand out, if you want your kids to succeed, teach them how to handle themselves, how to solve problems. That's what will make them one in a million. There are plenty of Ivy League kids who struggle to make good decisions, to take care of business, to think and speak clearly. There are geniuses out there who, quite frankly, will say and do things that will make you wonder how they managed to cross the street without getting hit by a car. This isn't to say that you should lower your sights. It's to remind you to make sure you're aiming at the right thing. Degrees, fancy credentials, all the right experiences. What does it matter if they aren't self-sufficient, if they can't get things done? October 8th. You have to let them struggle. No parent wants to see their kids suffer. It's almost more painful for you than it is for them to trip over their words, to scratch their heads over their homework, or to bumble their way through the early years of their career. But if they never struggle, they can't grow, they can't learn, and they can't get better. Thomas Edison, a genius and a business success, if there ever was one, had trouble with exactly this issue. He was so brilliant, so headstrong, so clear about what he wanted that he could not quite give his sons room to develop and learn. He couldn't quite figure out the line between boss and father. His wife wrote him a great letter once that stands out as advice to all parents. "You've made a success of your life," she said, "built up tremendous industries so successfully that you have nothing more to prove to the world that you are capable. All know it," she said. "Can't you be happy in just letting the boys struggle along with you to guide them?" she said. "Forget a little bit that you are Charlie's manager and be a father, a big father." Of course, it's wonderful that you care, that you die for them if necessary. But you have to forget a little bit, as Edison did, just how much you feel for them so that they can learn. And in this way, you'll save them so much suffering in the future. October 9th. You have to come up with challenges.
A good half of the art of living is resilience. Alain de Botton.
Of course, you want tough kids, kids who are active and resilient, who are healthy and competent. You want them to be able to overcome obstacles and defend themselves. And with all that, and to be always prepared for the ups and downs of life. But you can't just want tough kids. You have to make tough kids. Theodore Roosevelt was famous for taking his kids on long walks and leading them over boulders and through thick woods. He wanted to get them used to exerting themselves and solving problems. Cato the Elder, the great-grandfather of the towering Stoic, Cato the Younger, a man who rose through the ranks to become one of ancient Rome's most politically influential citizens, did the same thing. He trained his son Marcus in athletics, taught him how to throw the javelin, fight in armor, ride a horse, use his fists in boxing, endure the extremes of heat and cold, and swim across the roughest and most swiftly flowing stretches of the Tiber. You make your kids tough by challenging them and teaching them the rewards of those challenges. You make them tough by toughing things out together. October 10th. Yet don't be too tough. Many a tough parent has had to come to terms with the fact that each child is different and needs different things. Cato the Elder had to do just that with the challenges he designed for his son Marcus. As Plutarch writes, he had to account for the fact that Marcus was his own person. As he writes, since his body was not strong enough to endure the extreme hardship, Cato was obliged to relax a little the extraordinary austerity and self-discipline of his own way of life. As it should be, we raise tough kids by teaching them lovingly, patiently, and understandingly how to grow past their limits. Still, we acknowledge and respect those limits. We create challenges for them, but we are not the challenge. No, we are their ally. We are on their team. We love them, and we are working with and for them, not against them. October 11th. Be like this. Do you remember the viral video of the little 4-year-old Iranian boy trying to do box jumps? He tries and fails 9 times. And then his dad enters the frame and gives his son a pep talk. On the very next attempt, he lands the jump. On top of the box, he double fist pumps before jumping into his father's arms. This is what Luctor et Emergo, I Struggle and Emerge, is all about. It's not about pointless struggle. It's about being on their side, encouraging them, picking them up when they fall, telling them what they need to hear when they need to hear it. Be the box jump dad, not the bean dad. October 12th. Teach them that they decide the end of the story. When Vice Admiral James Stockdale was shot down over Vietnam, he was taken prisoner by the North Vietnamese. He spent nearly 8 years being tortured and subjected to unimaginable loneliness and terror. He had little choice in the fact that he was shot down or that he was taken prisoner. When asked how he made it alive, he said, "I never lost faith in the end of the story. I never doubted not only that I would get out, but also that I would prevail in the end and turn the experience into the defining event of my life, which, in retrospect, I would not trade." What Stockdale told himself and what helped him endure this terrible ordeal and others was that he possessed an incredible power. He could decide how he was going to use this experience in the rest of his life, however short or long it would be. Teach your kids that. Teach them to see hardships as fuel. Teach them to see an opportunity where others see an obstacle. Teach them that despite everything outside their control, they retain an incredible power, the power to choose what they do with what happens to them. They get to decide the role an event will play in their life. They have the power to write the end of their own story.